Hello and welcome to There's No Business Like, a podcast where friends and industry colleagues explore topics and interview leaders in our industry of professional theatrical touring. Hey, 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 what a great intro by me. It's your favorite podcast host, Danielle Van Hook, and I'm here today with my friends, Katie.
Hey, everyone. Katie Miller with the Midland Center for the Arts in Midland, Michigan.
Brian.
Hey, Danielle. Brian Zellmer from KU Presents in Kutztown, Pennsylvania.
Kevin.
Kevin Maynard, Quad City Arts, splitting the border between Iowa and Illinois.
And Josh.
Last and least, Josh Benson from Marion, Illinois.
All right. Well, thanks for joining us, especially...
Wait, hold on. Are we just going to ignore the fact that Danielle called herself the favorite and nobody contended with that? We're just like, we're okay with that now? Is that...
I think we all agree. I mean, we already know it's not Kevin.
Okay. That's true. Sorry, Danielle.
Okay. Well, thanks for letting me do my job that I don't get paid for. It's not actually my job. All right. So today I have a treat for your ears and your ears and your ears. I interviewed Allie Haynes Hamblin at the APAP conference in New York, and we're going to get that one started real soon. But before we jump into her brilliance, I would like to focus in on the fact that this is being released in the month of International Women's Celebration and very close to International Women's Day. And if the calendar had cooperated, it could be International Women's Day, but let's just pretend like it is, because every day is for women. So the question I want to ask you guys to kick off this episode is if you could just tell us a little bit about the influential women in your life that have been wonderful leaders.
So for me, we come from a family of very strong women who very clearly take charge of just about everything in the family. And then on a professional side, whenever I stepped into my role here at the Marion Cultural and Civic Center, there was a very strong woman who named Yolande Peterson, who at that point, she'd been on the board for 35 years. By the time she passed, she'd been on the board for 50 years and had been chairman of the board for 50 years and had been the only chairman of the board for the existence of the entity of the Marion Cultural and Civic Center. And she really took it upon herself to get me integrated into the business community and into the different social networks and social realms that I needed to be in the community. And she really guided me and showed me how to insert myself into the community in a way to where I was really a part of it. And I couldn't be more thankful for that in the way that that has led to success within this small community.
I love that.
This is a long list, I think, for me. I think we've had I've got some really great siblings. I've got two sisters who have taught me an incredible amount about just, you know, essentially some of the hardships that women face that I would not have known without, you know, growing up with them and without having those conversations. And both have gone on to, you know, incredible leadership roles. And especially one of them who, I mean, amazes me every day because, like, she is a boss. And she is also the person I don't talk to while she's at work because she is in work mode and can get a bit fierce. But then, you know, I've also had really great people in my life, you know, like Josh mentioned. I mean, when I first started at the Orpheum Theater, I had a woman in the community, Jeanette Klein, who helped, you know, show me around, gave me lots of advice and helped us, you know, accomplish many of our goals that we had for the Orpheum Theater. So there's, you know, and then I guess also, I mean, I'll bring back Stephanie Adams, or I guess Stephanie Taylor now, who got me into the arts to begin with. I mean, and this list just goes on and on. So I would not be where I am now without the incredibly influential women in my life.
Danielle, if listeners remember the conversation I had with you and Kevin in my interview this past summer, I listed a ton of influential women in my life by name and how they've influenced me and inspired me and changed my life. But I'm just going to add to that list, because I didn't have time in that interview to list everybody. So I want to call out one moment in particular from early on in my career when I was at the Playhouse at White Lake. I was the youngest arts and culture leader in the county at that point in time. And out of the 8 major cultural institutions in the county, 6 of them were run by women. The Muskegon Community Foundation was run by a woman, and both chambers of commerce in Muskegon and Whitehall were also both led by women. So these massive, major, important institutions, a majority of them were run by women. And being the youngest one in that group sitting in meetings, working on our arts and our countywide arts and humanities festival, just observing how they moved through the community and how they wielded their skills and their influence to make substantial change in our community had a huge impact on me. And they were just great examples, not necessarily individual mentors or anything like that, but just them as a group, seeing how they were like major leaders in the community, just set the stage for me and set an expectation for me that like women belong in those seats. They belong in the boardrooms. They belong as chairs of councils and committees and large scale arts organizations.
Amen.
Since coming to Midland and engaging really deeply in diversity, equity, inclusion, and accessibility work, it has not escaped my notice that every time I hop on a Zoom call or step into a meeting, a majority of the people who are doing allyship and accomplice work are women. And they are fierce and they are brilliant and they are putting themselves in uncomfortable positions to advocate for others. So I just wanted to list out a handful of these women that I have grown to know and love and admire. And they include Amy Beasley, Gina Wilson, Nikita Murray, Kelsey Hockaday, Trisha Fenby, Christy Plishka, and Erin Patrice. They have been so influential in my life and have helped me learn how to be a much better ally and advocate as well. And I don't think women get the due that they are owed, particularly in the diversity, equity, and inclusion space. So yeah, I love and admire all of these women. I'm so grateful for them.
Hells yeah.
Like Josh, I come from a family of very strong women too. Basically matriarchal kind of set up on both sides of my family, where my grandmothers kind of ruled the land. But I also have to mention my mother, because she was a single mom for most of my upbringing, working three jobs and putting herself through college one course at a time, starting when I was in second or third grade. And she graduated with her nursing degree the same year I graduated from high school. And I was so proud of her and so amazed by her dedication and just not giving up and through many hard times. And so and just creating a better life for all of us. And then, of course, my sisters, as Kevin mentioned his, I had two incredible sisters and we've gone through so many things together. And then there's several teachers, Janet Wetmore, my chorus teacher. I wouldn't be in the arts if it wasn't for her. Beth Carter, who sparked my passion for theater. And I wouldn't have even graduated if it wasn't for my English teacher, the late Andrea Brock, who believed in me more than I believed in myself. Of course, I had so many coworkers and I've had many women bosses, but three of them were just incredibly inspiring women. Amanda Mosier, she was my marketing director when I was the marketing assistant. And while I had a marketing degree and understood the principles of marketing, she taught me how to put that into practice because I honestly was lost. So I have to give her a huge shout out. Nikki Jones, the CEO of the Nikki Jones Agency, she was so strict with me about paying attention to details. And everyone thought she was so mean for doing that. But actually, she helped me to really make sure that I'm putting out a great product every time. And then she also took me on all of the sales calls and coached me for every drive. She just would coach me the whole time. And she was such an amazing teacher. And then Susan Eisen at the City of Loveland, when I was at the Rialto, she taught me about to be an inspiring leader and how to build your team up, how to champion success and really let people fail and support them through that whole process. She was just amazing. And then obviously so many coworkers and colleagues in the industry that have inspired me along the way, but I do have to shout out two special ones, Katie Miller and Daniel Van Hook. And I'll leave it at that because the list is just so long.
Like you guys, I have also been lucky to just be around and surrounded by really amazing, inspiring women my whole life. But currently in my job, at like all levels of leadership around me are really incredible women. Our new executive director, who we're so lucky to have, is Betsy May Salazar. And she came to us from the National Building Museum and has just been the best leader I think we could have asked for. And my direct supervisor, Sarah Shallern-Treff, is able to like let me fly and do the things that I want to do while still kind of keeping me grounded without really being a micromanager. And I just appreciate that about her so much. And we have a female technical director, Jennifer Garrett, who doesn't let anything get by. Our shop is, there's no sawdust. It's immaculate. Our stage is immaculate. Everything about the way that she has organized that part of our operation is genius. I mean, it's so good. I just appreciate so much working in an environment that has really incredible leaders, and they're not incredible because of their gender. They're, you know, they're just incredible people by right. I would say I hope you enjoy this interview, but I know that you will, that I did with Allie Haynes Hamblin, because she is such an incredible leader.
My name is Allie Haynes Hamblin. I'm the executive director at the Charles W. Eisman Center for Performing Arts in Richardson, Texas. It is a City of Richardson facility. My pronouns are she, her, and I identify as an arts administrator and creative professional.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much for sitting down with us. This is exciting because we get to be in person, which we often don't get to do here at the wonderful APAP conference in New York City. I'm excited to get to know you a little bit more. So tell me your origin story. How did you get to the arts?
I've been in the arts since before I was born. I come from a long line of artists and creative practitioners. My parents were both creative professionals. My mother was a singer. My father is a singer. He doesn't tour any longer, but he used to tour internationally with the ensemble that he sang with. My grandparents on both sides were performers. My grandmother was a singer with the same ensemble that my father toured with.
Oh, wow.
And then my grandparents on my mother's side were actors, writers, directors, designers. My grandmother on my mother's side started writing her autobiography before she passed because she has the most amazing stories. And I remember reading in her in some of her chapters that like she directed a play with Paul Robeson. And I was like, what the? Seriously? Like, holy cow. You know, I've been around it ever since I was born. And when I first started working for a producer, I talked to my grandfather and I was just like, yeah, I'm working on the producing side now. And he's like, what? Producer? They're all crooks. And I was just like, Grandpa, I'm not a crook. We had a lot of fun just like talking about the business.
Did you move around with them a lot as a kid too?
No. So once my mom met my dad and got married, like that was it. She was like, I want my kids to grow up in one place. So we were very fortunate to grow up. You know, we had one house from the time I was three until I was like in college when she sold it and moved. You know, as soon as I finished college, that was it. I took off for the East Coast and lived out here east for about 10 years and took all kinds of different jobs and lived in New York for a while. And that's when I started working for the producing side, you know, the evil producer warlords.
And it's like your evil origin story.
Yeah, I guess. I lived out here for about 10 years and I worked for a producer for about 6.5 years. And, you know, that's a tough job. I'm not shy to say like it burned me out. At 29, I was like, I can't handle this. I'm burnt out. I'm quitting my life and just going back to Colorado to convalesce for a year. I went home and like immediately all these people were just like, well, do you want a job? Like, we'll hire you. And I was just like, yeah, I really do need a job, I guess. So I was home for about 6 weeks and then was very fortunate to be offered a job at the Scottsdale Center for the Performing Arts. For me, having been on tour, been to all 50 states, a bazillion venues, Scottsdale was one of the top three venues, in my opinion, for the in the country. So I was really flattered and was just like, heck yes, I'm going to take that job. And probably wasn't the healthiest decision I ever made, but it was definitely the best career move I ever made. So I moved to Scottsdale and was just like, great, I'm so honored to work with this amazing woman, Kathy Ochsner, and this amazing team that she's built. And when I first got there, you know, Kathy was like, hey, we'll put you up in this hotel for a couple of weeks while you find a place to live. And I was just like, oh, I love this. I'm so being taken care of. And she was like, I have one favor to ask them. It's a 2-bedroom suite, so you have your own bedroom, but would you mind sharing with my daughter? Because my other daughter is about to have a baby, and so my younger daughter is coming into town, and my house is small, and yada, yada, blah, 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 blah. And I was just like, of course. You're taking care of me. Like, everybody here is lovely. Of course. We'll do it. We'll do it. First night in this hotel room, I'm sitting there with her daughter, Jenny, and we're just chatting, and she was like, gosh, you look so familiar. And I was just like, yeah, you look familiar to me, too. Weird. And she was just like, did you grow up in Denver? I said, well, yeah. And she was like, oh, my God, me too. We were on the same soccer team together when we were little kids. And my dad was the coach. And I was like, get out of town. So the next day I went to work and I was like, Kathy Ochsner, did your husband coach the Purple Sharks? And she was like, yes. What the what? And so it was crazy. So it turns out that like Kathy and I had known each other since I was a little kid. So bizarre. So I was just like, well, this is serendipity. Like, obviously, I was going to end up here no matter what. Like, wow. I didn't have any control over that. So that was just to me like the most like mind blowing, like, okay, I'm right where the universe was planning for me to be all along. Very cool.
So how did you get from the Scottsdale Center for the Performing Arts to Texas, to the Eisman Center?
I worked in Scottsdale for 13 years. And in that time, you know, I started as a company manager and worked my way up, eventually becoming the director of the center. During the course of those 13 years, I went back to graduate school and got my master's in business. I met a delightful gentleman and got married.
Ooh.
And, you know, it was like my life just has completely evolved over those 13 years. And I kind of like just taken stock of where I was and what was going on. And I had just started the APAPS Leadership Fellows Program,
okay,
which was life-changing for me. It was really like an awesome opportunity to be introspective and think about like what is really important to me, what really are my values in a professional environment and a personal environment. And, you know, I just came to the realization that this wasn't the right place for me any longer. Mm-hmm. And so I started just applying for other jobs and interviewing all over the place and, you know, looking at this and thinking about that. And am I going to move here or there? And I kind of wanted to move back to Colorado, but that opportunity didn't work out. And then my husband found this job listing for the city of Las Vegas. And a handful of people had emailed it to me already and said, like, this sounds like a cool job for you. And I was just like, I am not even qualified for this job. Like, why would you even send it to me? But I, you know, read it. And, you know, there was one day at work where I was particularly frustrated. And I was just like, forget it. I'm applying for that other job in Las Vegas. You know, just like a rage apply, you know, like you do sometimes. And
we've all been there.
So I just threw my hat in the ring, and it was for, you know, director of cultural affairs for the city of Las Vegas. And I got through the interview process, and then they flew me out to Vegas. And I was like, let me tell you this, like my first night there, it was a 2-day interview. My first night there, like I called my husband like in tears, because I was just like, this is the most depressing place I've ever been. These freaking machines never stop dinging, and these people are like zombies sitting in the machines. And of course I was staying in a casino hotel.
Yeah.
There's like one hotel in Las Vegas that's not a casino hotel. And I was just like, what am I doing here? My husband was just like, first of all, like, that's not real life. Those people don't live there. Like, just calm down and like, just go to the interview and meet the people. Like, he was like, you don't have to do anything. But he was like, don't psych yourself out, basically. So the next morning I got up and I went to the interview, and the city manager at the time for the city of Las Vegas was this amazing, dynamic woman who just had this incredible vision. She was hugely supportive of the arts. We got along so well. It was like we were best friends immediately, had this great connection. You know, we got really real in the interview where she was just like, hey, you don't really have any experience in this big part of the job. Like, what do you think about that? And I was just like, I'm scared of that part of the job. But I was just like, I realized that I actually know more about it than I thought I did. So I'm, you know, feeling a little bit better about it. But I was like, honestly, if I were to get this job, like that would be my first 6 months would be just diving headlong into learning as much as I could about public art, which was the thing we were talking about,
okay,
you know, learning as much as I could about it as quickly as possible, because I, you know, I don't want to be an albatross. But I said also, I like to build and manage a team in a way that I'm surrounded by people who are better at what they're doing than I would be if I was doing that, you know? So like, as long as we've got a great, strong team, like, I'm just going to get myself to a point where I can support them and I can bring them the resources they need to do the job. I don't have to be able to project manage a giant sculpture in the middle of the town square. You know, like, that's it. They know how to do that. Well, you know, I need to understand the resources that they need so that I can bring those to them. That will really be my focus. And she was just like, God, that's such a great answer. And I was like, oh, I so killed it. You know, it was just like, I thought like, okay, this is awesome. Clearly I got the job and moved to Las Vegas and immediately was handed this list of priorities and issues that they wanted to address, and this enormous audit that they had just gotten findings back from the auditors of, like, this giant list of things that needed to be fixed. And I was like, hey, awesome, I'll get right on top of that. I wasn't intimidated, but I was kind of just like, this is not exactly the scope that I thought it would be, but cool. Like,
it's like, what does the director of cultural affairs do?
So my role was to help shape public policy for the arts, oversee the Arts Commission, manage the staff, manage the facilities. We had three brick and mortar facilities, 3 mobile stages, 9 galleries, the public art collection of some 800 pieces throughout the city. Wow. So that was really my job, is like kind of that top level overseeing it. And what I found when I arrived there, you know, in addition to this list of like, this is broken, that's broken, the other's broken, we need this to be fixed, we would like that to be better, et cetera, et cetera. So I came in to be the fixer. I learned that really quickly. and then, you know, I had my own goals that I came in with. So the programming was like, I definitely wanted to be involved in the programming because I could see that there was a symptom of some of the issues that we were having, was that the way that the programming was being done was not really something that led to success. You know, I learned pretty quickly that when you are brought into a role like that in a department or an organization that's got a lot of problems that need to be fixed, that, you know, need to be solved, that's probably not going to be your long-term position. Because it will, there's no way to effectively do that and maintain a very, you know, popular persona. It put me in a position where I pissed a lot of people off. And, you know, that was unfortunate, but it was necessary in order to affect the changes that needed to be made. I left 5.5 years later, and I was very proud of everything that we had accomplished. The department was in really great shape, larger budget than they had ever had before in their history. And by the time I left, our public art collection had grown to over 1,100 pieces.
Wow.
And, you know, it was just, it was a really, really strong program. We had turned over a lot of staff positions, and we had built a really great staff and had turned some of our, you know, fledgling programs around in a significant way. And they're still thriving, which makes me so proud.
Wow.
At the city of Las Vegas, you're fully vested in the pension program at 5 years. So at 5 years, I started looking around like, okay, what's my exit strategy? And Bruce McPherson at the Eisman Center had announced his retirement in February. And I had known him since my touring days, because we toured Late Night Catechism to his venue in his inaugural season at the Eisman Center.
Ooh,
so when he announced his retirement, I thought, oh, that's, I mean, not really. The Eisman Center was a really beautiful place. And, you know, that's really like quality staff, great facilities. So I was like, I don't know, let's see. And I threw my hat in the ring, put in my application. Turns out the recruiter is a very dear friend that I've known for a long time. And his recruiting team was also comprised of people that I'd known for a really long time. And I put in the application, and he called me 20 minutes later and was just like, Allie Haynes Hamblin, did I seriously just get an application from you for this job? And I was just like, yeah. And he was like, tell me what's going on. So I told him, quick. And he was just like, all right. He was like, well, you're perfect for this job. My phone starts pinging with my LinkedIn profile, and was like, somebody who works for the city of Richardson just looked at your profile. And I was like, oh, that's, I love LinkedIn for that. Right.
Yeah.
And the next day he called me and was just like, okay, they're in, like, they want to talk to you.
Wow.
And I was just like, holy crap. And so from there, it moved really, really fast. I went out there and visited them the first week of July, and middle of July, they offered me the position. And so that's, you know, that was how I left Las Vegas and moved to Texas. And I'm so, so thrilled. It's just, it's such an incredible organization. It's a great city to work for. The facility is beautiful. And honestly, like, the staff there are all outstanding. It's, you know, one of the things that I talked a lot about with my staff in Las Vegas was that I wanted to create for our department effectively an arts organization that happens to be under the umbrella of a city.
Yeah.
So I wanted them all to start thinking like arts administrators and creative professionals, and not think of themselves as like city staff or, you know, clock punchers and that kind of thing. You know, a lot of like the stereotypical thing. And not necessarily that they were already thinking of that, but that's kind of like, there was a lot of behavior that like conveyed that. And so I said, look, like, we've got to make ourselves into an arts organization. I mean, weirdly, like,
well,
some people,
as people
didn't
that both work in municipal facilities, there is kind of a stigma about being a government employee, and just the greater culture is different than an arts culture. They're two wildly different industries, and they're very complementary. You know, having a city invested in arts, like, we could talk about all day about why that's so important and so necessary. But like, the being a worker in that environment, I always feel like I'm pulled between like
you know, I'm a part of the city. Like this is, I'm a public servant. I'm serving this place. I'm also a part of this arts industry, which is just so wildly different.
Yeah.
And I can imagine that being a real transition of just changing the lens in which you're thinking about what it is that you do.
Totally. Totally. So that was, you know, that was a big struggle in Las Vegas that, you know, I think we've addressed really well. But coming into Richardson and meeting with the staff there and, you know, my first couple of weeks working there, I was just like, oh, this is a team of performing arts staff. Like they are all arts professionals and they all come from arts backgrounds. And like this is what they do. Like these are artists. To me, it's the perfect scenario. It really is. Like I work for a performing arts center with a group of amazing arts professionals. And, you know, we get the wonderful benefits of working for a city and the support of having, you know, other city departments around us. So that was a huge, huge attraction for me. It was just this amazing staff and a beautiful facility and incredibly supportive city, you know?
Yeah.
So plus Bruce is nice.
Aww.
If you've never met Bruce McPherson before, you know, he's just a lovely gentleman.
So what's involved in the role that you're doing now?
That was another thing that's really attractive about this move is that I could really go back to my first love, which is the performing arts and focus on that. So as the executive director of the Eisman Center for Performing Arts, I oversee all of the programming and I oversee the budgeting and the facility operations and maintaining the staff. You know, I'm responsible for ensuring that, you know, the staff culture is where we want it to be and it's very healthy and that, you know, we maintain a great staff. So it's really like being an executive director for a traditional arts organization with the exception that I don't have a board to answer to. I answer to the city manager's office, which is two people. Well, for me, it's two people because I report to assistant city manager and then she reports to a city manager. You know, and we have a city council that is, you know, they are our policy making, goal setting body for the entire city, but they don't get involved in the day to day. They're not, you know, looking at budget detail every month like a board would. So they don't function like a regular board. So it's really kind of like
a way that the performing arts thinks of as a board, right?
Exactly.
I mean, because a government board is so same word. Wildly different roles.
Yeah.
So what is your leadership style?
I'm doing a little bit of a staff transition because I've been there for about 15 months now. So I kind of promised myself that I was not going to make major changes for at least a year. I really wanted to observe and learn and ask a lot of questions. So at the 1 year mark, I did make some significant staff changes to the org chart. That's part of like a longer term plan. So right now I have more people reporting to me than I would normally have. Ideally, I like that to be in the four, around the fours number. I'm also kind of a big believer in that structure. And that's honestly like that really comes from my theater background. You know, when you're backstage, it's not flat, can't be flat. Everybody can't be reporting to one person. Like you've got to have that chain of command to be safe. So my leadership style then is really, I'm very open, very collaborative. I like to ask a lot of questions and wait and let everybody else speak before I weigh in. I definitely would describe my management style as a like servant leadership. I really see my role as being the one to, it's my responsibility to bring the resources and the tools to the team that they need in order to do their jobs well. We engaged in this process when I first started. I held these like process workshops. I think we call them process improvement workshops, where it was really just an opportunity to convene big groups of the staff. And there were a couple of them where we had the entire staff in the room where I asked questions and then follow-up questions. And then what about this? To learn like what is the process that we follow to rent the theater? What are the rules required when we, you know, set up ticketing for somebody? Like, let's get down to like the nitty gritty of like these policies and those procedures and whatnot. And I had a staff member who came into my office and was like, hey, can I talk to you? And I was like, yeah, of course. And he sat down and he was just like, I have a question. Like, what's the point of these workshops? Why are you making us like spend our time like sitting around answering your questions and talking about all this stuff? Like, you know, what's going to come of all this? And I was just like, well, you know, I
fair
really,
question.
Yeah. Yeah. And I said, first of all, like, I have a lot to learn about this organization. I think this is a really efficient way to learn it quickly. I'm enjoying seeing the different staff groups together in the same room, answering the questions, because y'all are learning from each other. But I said, also, this is a cool opportunity for all these minds to come together and say, like, well, here's an issue that we're having, or here's something that isn't working. Because that was part of my process and my questions was, okay, this is how this works. Like, how do you feel about that? Is that working for you? I'm mapping out what you're telling me on the whiteboard, and I'm seeing like multiple touch points on this same thing. Like, that just, you know, that doesn't feel efficient to me. Like, can you envision a different way that might be more efficient, that would cut out a lot of this, you know, duplication or quadruplication in some cases? You know, can we talk through that? You know, and I said, I love having everybody's ideas in the room for that. And I really have been encouraging people, like, I want y'all to think about this and come up with some ideas and share them. And, you know, obviously we can't do everything, but, you know, this is, I want everybody's ideas. And he was just like, well, excuse me for saying this, ma'am. I live in Texas now, so I'm a ma'am. He said, well, excuse me for saying this, ma'am, but isn't that your job to tell us how all of this is supposed to work? And I was just like, yes, ultimately, I will be signing off on whatever the new policies or procedures are. Absolutely. And I said, but here's my perspective. I have been in this business a long time. I've managed facilities for a long time. I could just sit down at my desk and tell y'all, like, write it out and be like, this is how I want you to do it from now on. I don't care how you did it before. This is what I like, and this is what I think works. And bada bing, bada boom, here you go. You guys are going to do it like this now. And I said, would that be good? Yeah. Yeah, that'd be pretty good. I come up with a pretty good process. You know, I think it'd work just fine. But it's not going to be great. And I was like, if we can all get around the table and share our ideas, and everybody can understand that they've contributed to how we're operating and what we're doing, and they can have some agency over the part that they have to do, or they can say, like, hey, I know I don't work on your team, but I've got a really great idea, or I know, like, I've seen it work in other areas, in other, you know, organizations this way. I was like, if we do that process, then the policies and procedures that we end up with are going to be freaking great. Mm-hmm. And I was like, that's what I want for this organization. I don't want, like, yeah, pretty good. Allie did an okay job. I want, like, we all came together and did a freaking great job. I really, really crave that collaboration. And I worked with an executive coach for a little over a year when I was in Las Vegas, and he coined this wonderful term for it. He called it intellectual friction, to create that dynamic in the course of a meeting or a conversation among staff where we can have these arguments and disagreements with each other, and we're not screaming and yelling, nobody's disrespectful, but that we're having that, like, point, counterpoint, and what about this, and let me play devil's advocate on that, and it just creates this great intellectual friction that ultimately results in something better than what any individual would have come up with on their own. I love it when everybody feels comfortable enough to disagree with me. And, like, they'll disagree with each other all day long. Like, that's, there's no problem with that. But, like, you know, if I say, like, well, you know, what about this? I think we should do that. I've had staff groups who have just been like, okay, that's it. We'll do that. Fine. Whatever you say. Mm-hmm. And it's just like, no, that's not what I want. But then, you know, if I have a group of staff people that are just like, God, Allie, that's a terrible idea. Like, we can't do that. Or we really don't want to book that show. Like, there's not going to be an audience here for that. Or we don't think that's as good as you think it is. Or, you know, whatever mm-hmm. the case may be. To me, that is the tops. Because then it's just like, this is a completely safe environment. And I love the fact that I know I'm getting an honest response from people. And I know that, like, if something's going wrong, like there's some accident on stage, God forbid, or, you know, something goes sideways and, like, there's a huge accounting error, when that staff comes, you know, directly to me, or, you know, rings the bell immediately and just says, like, whoa, something went wrong and we need to fix it, and doesn't try to, like, hide it or fix it before I find out, that's another area where I'm just like, okay, we've got a really healthy work culture where, again, like, it's kind of all about safety. Right. You know, I really want people to feel safe that, like, I'm not going to scream and yell. Nothing's going to get thrown. Like, we're not going to, you know, have a big blowout about this, you know. And I know, like, there's a lot of people that do kind of have that leadership style where it's just like, hey, like when I'm mad, I'm just going to explode and then I'm going to come back and be okay. And it's mm-hmm. just like, well, I don't really like that eggshell environment that that creates. And there's, you know, it's not easy to get to that culture, but I think we had the building blocks in place at the Eisman Center to pull that together really relatively quickly. I mean, I've only been there for 15 months and I'm already yeah. feeling that and seeing some of these signs, you know, and we did have a couple of issues where there were a couple of people that would just, they get stressed and they,
yeah.
you know, lash out at people and scream and yell. And then they come back later and apologize, which I'm like, love the apology. Let's dig into why you freaked out. Like, what's going on? Well, I'm working a bunch of hours. I'm really tired. I didn't get my meal break and I'm hungry. And I'm just like, okay, here's the deal.
We can fix that. Yes.
It is more important to me that you take a meal break than that you power through and finish every single thing on that list. You know, like if I have to sit down with a client and say, hey, I'm really sorry, you're not going to have as long of a sound check as you hope for because our team needs to take a break and behave safely, that's worth it.
Yeah. So we've talked a lot about internal culture. Mm-hmm. How do you move into a city, into a totally different culture, environment? I mean, every city has its own unique culture and environment, and get to know the residents and the people that you're serving. And like, how do you get yourself so involved in that community that you can make programming decisions for them?
One of the things that was so appealing to me about taking this position and moving to Richardson was the fact that they were very upfront, the city administrators and some of our community stakeholders who were heavily involved, including Mr. Eisman himself. They were very upfront in the process and before I was even hired that they have every intention of taking me to things and bringing me to groups of folks and, you know, introducing me to the Rotary and introducing me to this, you know, the leadership program in town and taking me to the meeting of the presidents of all the HOAs and et cetera, et cetera. I said to my husband, like, here's the deal. This is, you know, a small community compared to where we've come from
right.
in a big city. And I said, my approach is going to be yes to any invitation that I get. So I was like, and you better be willing to come with me for at least half of those. And he was just like, I'll give you half.
Aww.
And actually he's done far more than that because he's really enjoyed it, you know? Yeah. And so we, you know, literally every invitation that we've got, people have had us over to our homes for meals. We have been invited to different, you know, mixers for the chamber. Of course, you know, every event at the Eisman Center I attend. And when we have our own presentations at the Eisman Center, this was something that I did in Scottsdale that I think was extremely beneficial to my leadership there. I do a pre-show speech before every single show, but I keep it quick. It's never longer than 60 seconds. And there's never a pitch in there for give us money or be a donor. It's only ever about gratitude. Hi, this is me. This is who I am. I introduce myself so they all can see who I am and know who I am. And then I just thank everybody for being there. And I'm specific, like, thank you for buying a ticket and coming to this show. And if you're a member, thank you for being a member. That is, you know, an extra layer of support for us that makes it possible for us to do what we're doing. Our entire staff is grateful to have you here. And now let's get on with the show. Like, that's it. It's just gratitude. Mm-hmm. Of course, if there's a sponsor, I say their name, yeah. you know. Of course, I watch the show, but at intermission, I'm walking through the lobby. After the show, I'm hanging out in the main part of the lobby and people are coming up to me and just being like, oh, it's so great to meet you. Oh, so welcome to Richardson. And, you know, and then sometimes people come up to me and like, it's too loud. Tell it. And I'm like, you got it. Like, that's what
yeah.
I'm here for.
Yeah.
And so that's been a really, really great way to meet a lot of members of the community. And then on top of that, like our first year, I was like, I want to get to know the cultural community here of the Dallas Metroplex, of course, Richardson, but even beyond. Mm-hmm. And so there was a period that like, oh my God, I think it was probably 2.5 months straight. Every single weekend I went to a performance at another facility. So I went to you know, all the venues that are the AT&T Performing Arts Center. I went to the Latino Cultural Center. I went to Shakespeare Dallas, which is a festival that takes place in the park. We just went to so many events. Every special event that the city put on, because our Parks and Rec department has a special events department. Every single special event we went to, and, you know, those were fantastic. So my husband really loves to go to those because yeah. that's, you know, outdoors and you can kind of chill. It was really fantastic. It was a really great opportunity to meet people and to be part of the community and for people to see that we were also part of the community. Because, you know, like there was a lot of press, a lot of people recognized me and knew who I was. So then I could introduce them to my husband and he could, you know, he could just be like, oh yeah, I'm her husband. Let's, you don't need to know my name, you know, that kind of stuff.
I want to switch a little bit away from the work that you're doing, that you get paid to do, and just into the service that you do for the arts industry. And I mean, you've talked about being an APEP fellow. I know that you were a president of Arizona Presenters. You know, a little birdie told me that you're on the slate to be elected to the APEP board here coming up. You're on the conference committee. And hearing about your leadership style and how you do that, I'm so happy to know that you're a part of the service of the industry that I work in. Because I know that all those things kind of affect lots of things that, you know, help us all work and be successful in our work. But like, why is that service important to you? Why is it that you do that?
I do volunteer a lot of my time on committees and boards and various other opportunities. You know, in the performing arts, there's a million different pathways to get into a role as an arts administrator or, you know, a practicing artist, anything. That does then present opportunities for mistakes to be replicated over and over again, you know? And so for me, it's a lot of this is really about, I want to do everything I can to further the field, codify the knowledge that's already been gained, and help the next generation to build upon the foundation that exists rather than recreating the wheel and making the same mistakes over again and learning the same lessons over again. And, you know, that kind of traps the field in this static state of, you know, not making progress. Mm-hmm. And so for me, that's a big part of it, is just like generating that education and generating that base of knowledge and creating these, you know, a way to help the next generation keep the ball moving down the field. Mm-hmm. I love sports analogies. I'm also, in addition to everything else, I'm a huge football fan. So pardon me and the sports allergies.
We'll allow it this one time.
Well, thank you. Thank you very much. So, you know, so for me, like that's a big part of it. And that's part of why I, you know, really love to participate in mentorship programs and leadership programs, serve on committees that support leadership and mentorship. The other side of that is that I feel just incredibly fortunate to have been able to build a career in this field and to have had so many opportunities to work in so many different roles and build a life where I can pay my bills. I can, you know, I have health insurance. I've got a retirement fund growing, you know, and all of this is because of my work in the arts. Mm-hmm. I have only been able to build that career because of the connections that I've made and the support that I've had from my colleagues in state consortia, in regional consortia, at APAP, you know, through the leadership programs and through the other community or committee service. A lot of that committee service and board service is really about giving back to this field that has given me everything.
Yeah.
I owe so much to California Presenters. That's how I, you know, had these relationships with the recruiters that filled the position at the Heisman Center. And I, you know, and I did a mentorship program with California Presenters that changed the trajectory of my career.
Wow.
You know, and so I was just like, I am so happy to continue to serve this organization, because this truly is like, as a treasurer of that board, like you are definitely volunteer labor, which I don't mind whatsoever. Mm-hmm. And I was like, I'm happy to continue serving in that way for as long as you'll have me or until my term expires, because I owe all of this to what California Presenters has been doing for me in my career since early 2000s. We're all in a huge time of transition right now. Mm-hmm. And everybody's kind of trying to reimagine like what do they do? How are they serving their membership? How are they serving constituents? Are the constituents that they're serving changing? And, you know, there's so much up in the air. It's also a really cool opportunity to kind of be at the table and help drive those innovative ideas forward. So,
yeah. And one of the things that I've enjoyed listening to you kind of talk about in your career is we can be in this business and thrive personally as well as professionally.
And I think that that's something really that this next generation, like probably the next couple of generations, you know, the millennials and then whoever's after the millennials, I stop keeping track. But, you know, that younger generation, I think, is really teaching us about the field that like there is balance to be had, you know, and just because we've always ever done it this way, we've always done 10 out of 12s, we've always done, you know, backbreaking, you know, 7 day a week gigs doesn't mean we have to do that forever, mm-hmm. you know? And I'll admit, like, I'm one of those who's, you know, grew up in the old school, paid my dues, like worked my butt off and, you know, struggled and struggled and struggled. And I felt like, you know, that was like, okay, that's what you do in order to earn that, mm-hmm. you know? And I'm one of those old schools that have just come to realize like, no, there's great lessons to be learned here. And I'm totally willing to adapt because I want that balance too.
Yeah.
And if I'm really going to hold true to wanting the next generation to start off in a better place, like I need to support that going forward. Like, okay, I want that balance. So now I want my, you know, entry-level staff to have that balance so that they come up in the field and come up into the management queue, knowing that balance and passing that on to their successors as well.
Yeah. And listen, we're not going to have time to get into all of this, but like, thank you for being that female leader and like allowing other young female leaders to see you working like that and to be serving and to, you know, to have a husband and to have all of this great career and, you know, to, you know, you've talked about how it's not always been perfect, like the yeah. whole way, but you don't know that you can be it unless you see it. And, you know, having so many different kinds of faces to look up to and for people to just see different kinds of female leaders and what a female-led organization can be like and can feel like, I want more of that into the world.
Yeah, yeah, me too. Thank you.
So you may or may not know this, but the podcast has no budget, but we do have a time machine.
Oh,
yeah. Yeah, we put everything into the time machine.
I dig it.
Yeah. So if I could, I'd love to take you back yeah. to being 29, being burnt out of being a producer, going home, trying to refigure what's going to happen, not knowing that you're going to have this incredible life mm-hmm. In the performing arts to continue. What advice would you like to give 29-year-old Allie?
Trust yourself and just go with the flow. Don't try to fight it. Just go with the flow because the universe is bigger than all of us and you will end up where you were meant to be at multiple times over. Right. And just trust and try not to overthink things. Try not to overthink everything, Allie. Try to give yourself a break every now and then. Yeah.
Good for you. Well, I mean, thank you again for taking your time here at this conference to share your story with us, talk about leadership. I've appreciated talking with you so much.
Thanks for having me.
Danielle, I have found another amazing woman that I want to be when I grow up. Allie, oh my gosh, this was just a masterclass in leadership. I am so glad that you had a chance to sit down with her. And I am just in awe, first of all, of everything that Allie has done in her career. And second of all, I've known Allie for a while through Presenter Consortium world, but I didn't know all this about her. And just the way that she presents herself and talks about leadership and the way that she talks about interacting with staff. I was just blown away by all of this. And I just want to like hang out with her all the time and be best friends and learn everything I can from Allie.
I agree, Katie. Allie, especially like the examples of when she came into the center in Richardson, Texas, and that she took over that role and brought people in and asked their opinions and worked on finding more efficient ways to do things, but didn't dictate it to them, had them work with her to where they had ownership of the processes from the beginning. And even when she was confronted about it with somebody saying, hey, what are we really doing here? Are we wasting our time? And her being able to talk to them and have that conversation, all of it is such a beautiful example of prime leadership in with a great team.
Yeah, it's a great example of trusting the expertise of your staff, which I think from her experience in Las Vegas and now in Texas, like that is one of the key things I took away is trusting the expertise of your staff and taking the responsibility for then finding the tools and supports that they need, right? That's like one of the signs of a true leader. Yeah, total agreement, Josh.
I absolutely agree. The way that she talks about her leadership style and the way that she leads her organizations that she's been a part of is what I strive to do. And so I can only hope that I am half as good as she is. I mean, just hearing the way that she talks about her team, talks about her organizations is truly inspiring. And I often think about when I hear leaders talk of like, if I could see myself working for them, after having like a leadership role, like sometimes it's hard to be able to take that step back and be able to be sort of like in a role that like answers to somebody. But I've realized that there are people like that, that I can. And I was listening to Allie and I was like, I would work for Allie. Like I would love to have that opportunity.
I have to relate to that whole part of her story, because when I first started at a place, and I'm not going to date it or say which place, but I had a meeting with my new staff, and one of the women that worked there a long time kind of combated every suggestion I had and kind of put down things. And then afterwards, everyone left and she got all upset and came to me and said, okay. And she figured she was going to be written up because that had happened to her with a previous boss. And I said, why would I write you up? And, you know, she said, well, because I disagreed with you. And I said, well, I'm glad you did. I don't want a yes person in this meeting. Like I feel honored that you feel comfortable enough to speak your opinion, you know, your honest opinion with me. And I feel like I can trust you for that. Like, please don't stop ever doing that. And she was just amazed that, you know, because she had gotten reprimanded for that type of behavior in the past. So it's just, you know, I love that kind of leadership and leaning on your staff, because they are there for a reason. And we're there as a leader to support them, not to just make them be yes people.
And I will say too, it kind of killed me a little bit whenever Allie was talking about her tenure in Las Vegas. She said, you know, if you're brought in somewhere to be like a fixer, it's hard to make that place be the place that you stay for a long time. I can definitely see why that would be the case. But it is something that I hadn't ever really considered or thought about before. And what a difficult role that would be in. And she talked briefly about it, but, you know, working with an executive coach like around that time, I'm sure was really helpful in that. And I think it's like so great to reference, even when you are in the leadership role, to that there, you know, there are mentors and there are other ways that you can still get professional development to make you better at the thing that it is that you need to do. And, you know, obviously makes Allie such a strong and amazing leader. But that perspective of being the fixer was not one that I had heard before.
Yeah. And that is a real skill to be able to do that, because it is not easy to come into that situation and essentially just starting to accept that, you know what, I'm not going to be liked here. And that is difficult. And, you know, you sort of have to be able to compartmentalize that. I mean, because it's tough to not take that home with you. But, you know, on the backside of that, being able to see everything that she was able to accomplish there, I mean, she said she was proud. I mean, it was rewarding. And so, you know, those tough decisions, I mean, led to a thriving, an even more thriving culture organization.
Danielle, I also really appreciated when you asked her about her service and giving back, and how she tied her experience with California Presenters and how that helped her career. And she's now giving back and hoping to help the next generation.
Danielle, one thing I wanted to note about Allie's story was when she was ready to move on from her ED position down in Arizona and applied to the job in Nevada. She said, like, she mentioned that she didn't feel that she was qualified for that position, right? But she ended up rage applying anyway, which I loved. It made me chuckle. She ended up rage applying, went into the interview and had that conversation with the city manager at the time about how she didn't have a lot of experience in public art, and had that very vulnerable, very straightforward conversation about like how she would learn and but also trust her staff and that sort of thing. And it just made me reflect on moments in my career and conversations I've had with other women. And you see this a lot just in media and different studies about how women absolutely do not apply for jobs that they are 120% qualified for, because there is this inherent fear that they are not good enough, that they're not going to be considered. But we see other people who are absolutely not qualified have all the confidence in the world and apply for those jobs anyway. And so it just really struck me. And I was so glad that whether it was that moment of rage or like some hidden like confidence in herself that brought her to apply for that and then go through that process, I was so glad that she did. And I think it's such a brilliant example for other young women in the industry to just go for it. And I'm really hopeful that in the future, when I am thinking about those opportunities for myself, I will think back on that moment in Allie's, in your conversation with Allie. And like, I hope I will feel empowered to go after what I want, even if I only check 100% of the boxes instead of 120% of the boxes.
Yeah, Katie. And, you know, along with that, we also have to trust all the people in our lives who know us, who know our skills. And, you know, if five people send you the same job, that's a sign, right? We also have to listen to those people who do really know us.
Allie also highlighted how important it is, networking is, and knowing people, because that connection also helped her jump ahead where they've already closed the position. But because of that connection and relationship she had, she got right in and now has the position. So she also just highlighted that important piece as well.
All right. So I've just got one thing left to say for this episode, and it's, let's hear it for the girls. Okay. So thank you for indulging me on that. Thank you so much to Allie for sitting down with us, sharing your story, sharing your inspirational tips about leadership. I took a lot of notes. I hope you all did, or if you're driving, maybe you stop and take some notes later, because please don't put yourself in danger. Catch you on the flip side.
All right, everyone. Thanks for listening to There's No Business Like. Our producers and hosts are Brian Zelmer, Josh Benson, Kevin Maynard, Katie Miller, and me, Danielle Vanhoof. Views expressed in this podcast are ours alone and are not reflective of the organizations we are a part of. Keep up with us at nobusinesslike.com. There you'll find links to all of our episodes and socials. If you like this podcast, give us a like, a follow, a review, or our favorite, a 5-star rating. Oh, wait, what was that site? I got it. Don't worry. It is nobusinesslike.com. Do I sound out bus-I-ness every time I type it? Yep, sure do. Stay in touch, my friends.
I just realized her initials are
I agree.
Yep.
We all agree. All of us. I can't get that out of my head now.
Same.